We gather here because certain questions call to us. We seek a deeper and more enduring meaning for our lives. We ask what we owe to our friends, to our loved ones, to our children, and to the future, that the world might be a little better because we were here. We ask how to recognize good, how to confront evil, and how to become the kind of people we were meant to be. These questions and more like them arise within us and call our names. And so we gather here in this church, and our business together is blessed by the yearnings that have collected us. That is why we can say it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us bring it down to a whisper and make room for silence. We come here with our private thoughts, our personal joys, sorrows, hopes, and fears. We come knowing that we have done things we ought not to have done and have failed to do things we should have done. Take these quiet moments to light a candle of memory or hope to give visible form to some of your special feelings, or to sit quietly and just be here now. When people pray, they direct their thoughts in so many different directions. Some send them to God, some to the better angels of our own nature. Some just concentrate, knowing that focusing our thoughts may strengthen our life force. Wherever you send the words, however you would personally express this need, let us pray. Help us to focus our life force. Don't let us become so scattered, so diffused by the many demands of life that we lose the sense of who we are and lose contact with our important relationships. Help us to be more present with those we love. Help us be more fully present to those ideals and causes that call our names. And help us to be more present to ourselves so that we may be more fully aware of who we are and who we are called to become. So much attention and energy are required by the transient things of life. Let us not lose sight of its more enduring and precious aspects. Let us not forget how important it is that we try to connect ourselves with the most life-giving parts of ourselves and our world. Help us to be more fully present to ourselves and to those people and callings that need our love and attention. Help us to be more fully present here, now, and always. Amen. The sermon title actually came from a Buddhist story, one of my favorite. It's a modern Buddhist story about the Buddhist who was trying to be present, as Buddhism says you're supposed to be, but he was having trouble understanding exactly why you're supposed to be present, believing that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. He was trying to be ready as he walked down the street and trying to figure out what sorts of signs from the world around him were signs that a teacher was about to appear. And he heard a noise of a couple hundred people in a large rental hall he passed by. So aware that the teacher can come from anywhere, he stopped in the rental hall. It was a big bingo game. And there, on the front wall, at the front of the room, was the lesson he'd been preparing to hear. A sign in large capital letters that said, You must be present to win. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. It can happen anywhere. Part of what the story is about is also the fact that he had to choose to be present, or he would never have seen the lesson. And it helps to look in places where we're most likely to find some wisdom. Not even Buddhists would teach that you should be hunting out bingo games as sources of wisdom. There are more likely places to find it. And that's another Buddhist teaching that many people don't know. Buddhism talks about the Eightfold Path toward Enlightenment, the eight right ways of thinking and acting and so on and so forth. People don't know that there's a ninth right thing to do. That's actually the very first. Buddhists teach that before you can even begin on the Eightfold Path of the right ways of being and doing and thinking and so forth, first you have to find the right associations. You have to hang out with the right kind of people. You have to hang out around people and places that cherish the parts of life that need to be cherished rather than the other parts. If you can't start with the right associations, you're not likely to do it alone. There are too many distractions. So usually Buddhists seeking wisdom wouldn't look for bingo games. They'd usually look for the right kind of community, the right kind of associations. And I think that's as good a definition as I've heard this week for what a church is. I think more than any place in our society, a good church of any flavor is a place of right associations. Last week I talked about Georgia, the sister of a colleague of mine. Georgia attends a very small, very conservative Baptist church in a tiny town north of Fort Worth. Her church pays to send their high school kids to Montana and Idaho every summer to help clean and paint homes on Indian reservations with the Blackfoot Indians. They pay to send them to Mexico, to poor villages in Mexico, to do the same. And they help them find assignments in countries all over the world where they can be of service to others, because they're taught that they can transform the world through heartfelt service. That's right associations. My younger brother, who some of you met a year ago, had attended Unitarian churches for a decade and then left them to join fundamentalist churches as he raised his three children, because he found conservative churches that were more concerned about morality, ethics, families, and service to the world than Unitarian churches were. His daughter, Jordan, who completed airborne training in June, spent the next 2 months of this summer at the church camp that she's attended for the last 6 years, where she could finally be a cabin leader since she was 18, an airborne qualified cabin leader. Each week, the kids in the church camp were given different themes to focus on for the week. The week that my brother visited the camp, the theme for the week was, "Love is all we need." And the campers talked about it, thought about it, wrote and acted out plays and skits about it. Jordan, my niece, wrote a one-act play that her cabin put on for "Love is all we need." And when Peter and I talked about it, he said, "Where, can you tell me, are the Unitarians doing anything for their kids that even approaches a two-month summer camp like this?" And I thought, well, we're doing a lot for our kids, but we're not doing that. There's a place to grow. I know many Unitarians, and I've heard this from Unitarian pulpits so many times I want to scream and throw things, who believe that only stupid people attend fundamentalist churches. Not only is that not true, it's not even close. My brother didn't get dumber when he joined a fundamentalist church, and he didn't lose his PhD. He found something he hadn't found before. I think it'll be healthy for us to realize that one reason conservative churches are so much bigger than liberal churches is because they usually do so much more. They're usually involved in so many more aspects of the lives of their people. They have so many more programs than we can do. Now, we're working toward this, but we'd be foolish if we don't try to learn from the churches who are already doing it. There are plenty of large churches, even in the Austin area, that are doing this right. I'll pick just one of them that's a church I admire a lot. It's Tarrytown United Methodist Church. They're in a very upscale part of town. They have 2,000 members. And they spend over 25% of their annual budget on social and civic projects outside the walls of their church. 25%. That's astonishing. I think we have to be proud to have a church like that in our community. And if you meet someone from Tarrytown United Methodist, I hope you tell them so. And I think that it's a gift to us because we can use it as a spur to motivate us toward reaching out farther and more. What a wonderful way to nourish life, the life of their members, even not counting for a minute the life of all the people outside their church. That's a place of right associations. It's wonderful. So being present isn't just for people. This isn't just a guilt trip to make people bad when they come to church, though I do think that you should suffer while you're in church. And trying to be a place for right associations, I think, is the most important mission any church has. It's the most important thing we're about. We have a very simple mission statement that guides me and guides our board, and it's simply to make a positive difference in the lives of our members, our children, and our larger community. That's right association. That's the minimum a church has to do to be a church. And we're certainly doing that. I don't think, here's my controversial suggestion for the morning, I don't think there is another institution in our society that is more worth investing money, time, and energy in than a good church, regardless of its denomination. If we're trying to support places that honor the ultimate questions and values of life, I don't think there's anywhere in our society that you can get a better return on your investment than investing in a good church. Think about that this week. Last week I talked about Georgia putting $100 a week in the collection plate at her church, which may represent more than 15% of her earnings. She didn't make much money. My brother is a college professor, always pledged 10% of his gross pay. I've never pledged that much. I'm not acting holier than thou. I've always been cheaper than that. It's true. I could sugarcoat it, but it's true. And when I hear Peter tell me this, and he's certainly not telling me to play one-upmanship, I envy him. I know he's found a way to connect with a center of values that I'm still working toward, and I think a lot of us are working toward. And I'm convinced that these people I know and most of the people I don't know do it because they want to support places of right association. They want to be present in every way they can, just as we do in this church. And they will tell you that they've already won there many times. Peter told me that he won during the week he visited Jordan and his younger daughter in that summer camp in more ways than he could count. You're present. You can win. Now, about this time, I'm not as naive as you may think. You know that a message like this that talks about investing in a church is as crazy as it gets in the world we're living in. You don't hear this anywhere. Every television ad tells us to buy things. Television ads are working to redefine us from being humans to being consumers. They're very different. Every television ad tells us to buy things for ourselves, buy things for our spouses, buy things for our children, buy bigger, newer, trickier, and more expensive things. This is a religious message. It's a bad religious message, but it's a religious message. It's the religious message called salvation through accumulation. The more stuff you got, the more saved you are. And then when you got too much stuff, you've heard George Carlin's bit on this, then you buy big Tupperware containers to put your stuff in. So you can fill every available, even under your bed, you can fill with stuff now. They have big plastic containers. And then your friends will say, what is all this stuff? And you say, I don't know, I haven't looked at it in years, but I got stuff, baby. I'm saved. I got all the stuff I need. Our newspapers are still carrying stories of the corporations whose huge frauds robbed their workers and others of billions of dollars. This is certainly not true of all corporations, but it's true of some of them that have made the front pages of the papers. Because the individuals in charge got greedy, thought they could get away with it, and thought that stealing money from others was the sort of thing that decent people do. I'm serious about this. You can't imagine them saying publicly, well, I know this is a slimy thing that only indecent people do, but I'm really proud of it. At some level, they have to think that that is behavior that decent people do. It's not hard to see where they would get a message like this. They give a bad name to the people in good corporations who would never act that way. And they're the majority. But it's not hard to see where they'd get a message like this. The message of our society is looking out for number one. When Ivan Boesky told that class of Harvard students 15 years or so ago that greed is good, he was chanting the mantra of the religion of a very perverted kind of capitalism that's defined much of our world for the past 20 years or more. Salvation by accumulation. The one with the most toys wins. Being saved by things we own, saved by owning enough of the right things. You're more apt to find wisdom at a bingo game. And these greedy excesses, for the record, do not come from the liberal permissiveness of the 1960s. They come from the advertising mantra of the 1980s and 90s and the first years of this century, that teach salvation by accumulation and turn humans into consumers. That didn't come from the liberal culture. Now, against this background, it may sound odd to suggest that the most rewarding investment you can make with your money, time, and spirit is a good church, regardless of its denomination. But I'm convinced that it's true. I think of a saying attributed to Jesus, one that's very easy to misread. When he said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? The soul word is very confusing. It's easy to think it's a little gas bag or something. It's this thing somehow that's going to float off somewhere and live somewhere, and it's some supernatural thing, and space aliens have them. It's not what the word means. It's not what it meant to Jesus either. The word soul is a word that the Greeks worked for 2 centuries to construct, 2600 years ago. They were looking for a word to describe what's most essential about a human. What's the most important thing about a human? And they considered several words. Is it intelligence? That's one of the words they thought. It's intelligence. And they said, no, that isn't it. We know some really smart idiots. Is it just the breath of life, merely being alive? I mean, that's what makes us different from rocks. Is that really enough? No, that's not enough. There's some living people that are pretty awful. What is it? Is it property? Is it stuff? Is it money? No. They said what it is this collection of really noble ideals that give life, that give authenticity, that withstand any kind of scrutiny and that everyone admires. Now, those are very hard to describe, but when you can get them together, they are what make a human being worthwhile. I think it's true. There's another Christian concept about this. One you may never have heard of, and if you have heard of it, probably sounds so strange you wonder why anyone would bother. It's a Christian concept called incarnational theology. It's about the only kind of theology I've ever liked. And what all those syllables mean is that real faith is simply shown by living it. Don't tell me what you believe. I'll watch you, and I'll learn. That's what a lot of scholars say was so unique about Jesus, that he lived his beliefs. He was present. That's what was unique about the Buddha. That's what Buddhism is about. That's what any religion is about. Really being present and filled with the kinds of things that we think are valuable. What does a profit a person if they gain the whole world? They accumulate all the things that a house and a garage can hold, even aided by all those Tupperware containers, and don't gain anything that nourishes their soul. To nourish our souls, we have to invest in them and in the relationships and institutions that serve them. And I want to ask you where you think you are more likely to find that kind of right association that can fill spiritual hungers and nourish your soul. In advertisements, on Wall Street, or in a healthy church? You must be present to win. I think of this every time I do another memorial service. This may sound morbid to say, though it isn't. I wish more people would attend more memorial services. Because if you go to them and listen to what's said when we're trying to memorialize someone who died that we cared about, you find that people know just exactly what matters in life. There is no mystery involved. Now, this may be hard to believe in America, but I have never, in 16 years of doing this, never ever once have I heard a eulogy that listed the person's stuff. Never. It's amazing. I've never heard anyone suggest that the reason this person was so memorable was because they owned so many neat things. Never. What makes people matter, and you hear this at every memorial service, is that they were present. They were there when others needed them. They were real. They reached out. They cared. They were there. I've also never heard a eulogy praising someone because they were absent. Think of the things that we know matter in life. They don't cost a penny. They just cost attention and presence and being there. This is also a lesson you learn from parents, looking back on years they raised their children. I've never heard a parent say they wish they'd spent a lot less time with their kids. You hear them say they wish they had been able to find ways to spend more time and better time. Been able to find ways to juggle all the demands there are on parents today with work and home and family and kids. They wish they'd been able to find ways to spend more time and better time, not less time. Most of us can remember the hit song Harry Chapin had on this story 20 years ago, the song Cats in the Cradle. It's a story of a father who raised a son but just never had any time to spend with him because he's got work to do and other things. Finally, his son grows up and has children, and the father calls him and wants to spend some time with him. And the son says, you know, gee, Dad, I'd like to, but, you know, I got the kids and I got all these other things. And the father reflected on it and realized his son had grown up just like him. That's a lament over not being present and having passed on the habit of not being present to the next generation. That's a serious lament. It's a lament over not having had the right associations, over not having invested in the things that pay dividends to our souls. And this can come out. This isn't just, you know, religious topics aren't so esoteric that you have to go to a convent to experience Him. These come out in very simple, everyday ways that don't seem to have anything at all to do with religion, but that do. And I'll share one with you, since you can see the evidence of it out in the gallery. As many of you know, in a former life, I was a combat photographer in Vietnam and a professional photographer known to studio in Ann Arbor for 8 years, 9 years. In 1976, I sold all my equipment and stopped taking pictures for almost 25 years because I suddenly discovered that I didn't like photography and that I never had. Now, you may wonder how you can do something for 9 years and not know that you don't like it. It happens. And I'm not the only one in the room who's done this. I mean, there are only probably one or two others, but it happens. 2.5 years ago, during a quick trip to Mexico, we went up to the ghost town of Real de Catorce, up in the Silver Mountains, way, way up. And I suddenly discovered that I was seeing pictures again for the first time in a quarter century. This astonished me. I don't know how to describe that, but if you do that, you'll know the difference between seeing pictures and not seeing pictures. And I took the pictures I saw with my little point-and-shoot camera and found out that they were the pictures I saw. They were good pictures. I have two of those big enlargements on my office wall. Not only that, I discovered that I really liked seeing them and taking them. And it felt like there was a gift that didn't have anything to do with me, but that was coming through me that could record pretty things. Returning to photography as a fairly serious hobby was one of the biggest surprises of my life. I'd been gone for 25 years from it, and I had never missed it. I didn't like it. It was easy, but I didn't like it. I returned to it because now, for reasons I do not understand at all, it feeds my soul. It's a gift to be able to see good pictures. And for the first time, it's a gift that feeds me too. I have no idea why. I didn't expect it. Now I've invested thousands of dollars in photo equipment because I want to get back into this and have good equipment and do this right and serve these things that seem to give life. But the key is that we have to go where spiritual nourishment is. We have to support the activities that feed us. You must be present to win. And there can be terrible penalties for not being present. I have a story about this from the physician Rachel Naomi Riemann. I've used some of her stories a lot in the last year or so. I really love her writings. She attended a retirement dinner for a medical school faculty member while she was still a med student. And she wrote this. She's a good writer, so I want to read it the way she wrote it. He was internationally known for his contributions to medical science. Later in the evening, a group of medical students went to speak to him and offer our congratulations and our admiration. He was gracious. One of our number asked him if he had any words for us now at the beginning of our careers. Anything he thought we should know, anything of wisdom he'd learned from all of his years in medicine. He hesitated. Then he told us that despite his professional success and recognition, he felt he knew nothing more about life now than he had at the beginning, that he was no wiser. His face became withdrawn, even sad. "It has slipped through my fingers," he said. None of us understood what he meant. Talking about it afterwards, I attributed it to modesty. Some of the others wondered if he had at last become senile. Now, almost 35 years later, I do understand, and my heart goes out to him. Now, you've heard this story before. This is one of the most famous stories we have. You can't say this great doctor wasn't present in life. He was present to his students. He influenced hundreds or thousands of them. He was a blessing to them. He was a blessing to the medical profession. You can't say he wasn't present anywhere. He was, and that counts for something. But by his own admission, there was another realm of life where he had not been present and he had not won. It has slipped through my fingers. And that counts for something too. This is the story of Rip Van Winkle. You know the old children's story of the man who went to sleep for 20 years and woke up under a tree with nothing to show for it but a beard. And like all stories, this really isn't a story about a bearded man. This is a story about being present. It's a story of people who are there but not all there, who are there but not really present, and who have nothing to show for their time because it slipped through their fingers. There were all kinds of things going around Rip Van Winkle during those 20 years that he didn't see, for which he wasn't present. Maybe he never got to see that sign in the bingo hall that could have told him the secret he needed to save his life. Maybe he never joined a good church. Maybe he never found any other way to join the right associations that he needed to nourish and save his soul. If there's a lesson in this, Buddhists would insist there must be. That lesson may be to say that when you come to a good church, for goodness sake, be here. Don't go to sleep here. This is a place to awaken your spirit, to nourish your soul, to enlarge your life. Invest your money, your time, your energy, and your spirit, and be here. There's a lot to win here. For us, for our families, for our children, for our community. But in at least this respect, church is like life, which is like bingo. When we really are present, we really can win.